Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 280 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scene and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers, and just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I have spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, and space. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start this week's show in the first week of February with some more insights from the gardening world outside the U.S. borders. Our first article by Sarah Langford was published in the Financial Times of London on the 23rd of January. The Land Gardeners Break New Ground with a Radical Somerset House Show. The horticultural pioneers are co-curating an art exhibition in London that spotlights the transformative power of soil, fires up biodiversity activism, and unites the rigor of science and the awe of beauty. In the film Love Actually, an aged rock star, played by Bill Nighy, created a cultural moment. "Yes, I have, ant or deck," he quips in response to the pair of British television presenters. The joke was that ant or deck were so alike and seen so often together that many could not tell one from the other. So it is with anyone in the world of agroecological gardening and farming who has crossed the path of Henrietta Courtauld and Bridget Elworthy. Known as the Land Gardeners, the two women not only share a backyard as barristers, careers as garden designers, and a mission to communicate the wonder and importance of soil with those who still think of it only as dirt, they also wear the same clothes. Courtauld and Elworthy founded the Land Gardeners in 2012. Initially a cut flower growing business with a focus on soil health, the company has expanded to encompass garden design, publishing, workshops, and, crucially, a not-for-profit educational platform for sharing their extensive research on soil health. Their reputation for the latter now sees them co-curating a three-month exhibition at London's Somerset House. Titled Soil, the World at Our Feet, it features more than 50 works by contemporary artists from film to sculpture, as well as historical artifacts and contributions from scientists. Its mission is to explore and celebrate the power and potential of soil. The world at their feet, indeed. It started outside the nursery gate, Courtauld explains, of their matching work uniform. Our children were wearing smocks, and so we had our own made. Both had pivoted from law into postgraduate diplomas on garden design. But the synergy happened when Elworthy hosted her daughter's third birthday party. Where most mothers send guests home with cake, she sent hers off with a book about compost. Courtauld still has hers. For Elworthy, the light bulb moment had come back on her farm in her native New Zealand in 2004, when the enormity of climate change dawned on her. It felt paralyzing, she says, but my thought was that if we could get the soil right, everything would go from there. Back in the UK, the women held meetings in cafes, writing plans on paper tablecloths. Courtauld has kept these too. In 2014, she wrote a note that could have found its way into the speech that Steve Reed, the UK Environment Secretary, made at the Oxford Farming Conference just a few weeks ago. This is an unsustainable future for farming. We need farms and gardens that sustain both soil and body. Their gardening collaboration began within the walled garden of Elsworthy's house at Wardington Manor in Oxfordshire. Previously a working yard, mostly for burning rubbish, the soil was lifeless. They restored it, experimenting with homemade compost and techniques such as mixed planting and cover cropping, tulips grown with field beans, then planting cosmos into it, followed by phacelia. Plants were not grouped off. Instead, they grew herbs alongside vegetables, cut flowers and fruit all together. This, said Courtauld, was key. Diversity above ground means diversity below ground. Nature responded with growth that was, said Elworthy, almost frightening. As the soil transformed, the plants became shiny with more plasticity. They began to move like hair in a Wella advert. They found themselves with great armsfuls of sweet peas, 20 to 50 centimeters long. There were no problems with pests and disease. They flowered for longer in the vase. We thought, we're onto something here. A successful cut flower business followed, but it was more than the sum of its parts. The flowers were the way in, the beacon that attracted everyone, said Elworthy. They gave tours and talks about growing, but 10 minutes in, we were talking about soil. More experiments followed. We were just mixing potions, said Courtauld. We had kids' goggles on, long coats, stirring mixtures we'd made because we'd been to see sustainable agriculture expert Eugenio Gras working with biofertilizers. It was not just the results that motivated them. We were exploring, says Courtauld. And to do that, we had to get our hands in the soil rather than sitting in a studio, which was much more interesting. They thought they were just experimenting, searching for solutions and weaving them into their horticulture business. But when scientists started to visit, Courtauld said, we knew we had to start taking it seriously. The pair began to move their ideas out into nearby parks and farms to enhance biodiversity. On one farm, where the initial plan was to plant forestry, for example, they have planted mixed swaths of truffle oaks along side alleys of walnuts and hazelnuts, bordered with hawthorn, dog roses, elderflowers, cherries, sea buckthorn, and blackthorn. The name the Land Gardeners was partly a nod to their focus on gardening the land rather than plants, partly to wartime land girls and characters like Beatrix Havergal, who, Elsworthy explains, led an amazing education of women in horticulture. The pair have now worked on nearly 60 gardens from England to Italy. Architect Ben Pentreath, who has worked with them on multiple projects, including one in Cornwall and another for shoe designer Charlotte Dalal, says their pioneering approach is founded in the radical connection between soil, food, nature, and the meaning of a garden that is the antithesis to a culture obsessed with visual effects and instant results. Karen Spencer, who enlisted the Land Gardeners' help with the restoration of a 12-acre walled garden on the Althorp Estate in Northamptonshire, says their genius lies in combining a scientific approach to soil with the art of creating enduring beauty. It's the kind you can feel when you step into the garden. Their research has led them to visit pioneering growers around the world, from Cuba to India, returning to a lab in Wiltshire to apply what they have learned. In 2021, they launched a climate compost, really an inoculum, they explain, and more recently, tonics. There is no silver bullet, warns Courtauld. Feeding the soil is a dance with the soils and inputs you have and the resources you have available. But there's so much to learn. It is really exciting. Their science geek side has paid off in hard evidence. Soil tests taken from Wardlington's walled garden show we raised the soil organic matter from 5% to 12 to 15% in 10 years. In 2020's lockdown, a kitchen table conversation with the artist Nancy Cadogan became a book, Soil to Table. Blending recipes from chef Lulu Cox with Cadogan's paintings, it interwove a history of soil with explanations of the importance of microbes and compost with glossy pictures. In doing so, it reached a new audience. There were people coming to our courses who never would have before. The women became convinced that art had a role to play in their mission. As Courtauld puts it, we needed to create a link between the rigor of science and the awe of beauty. Their target was Somerset House. After spending 2 months researching artists working with soil, they prepared a pitch and found themselves pushing at an open door. Our program is anchored in contemporary issues of our time, says Claire Catterall, senior curator at Somerset House, who, along with May Rosenthal Sloan, has co-curated Soil with the Land Gardeners. Soil is so important, yet so little understood. Bringing together a diverse powerhouse of artists lets us offer solutions that imagine a better future, but also make it magical, as soil itself is. The exhibition is divided into three themed sections: life below ground, life above ground, and hope. Its stated ambition is to illustrate soil's role as a great interconnector, making all life on Earth possible, and its crucial relationship, particularly to human civilization. Fragility and environmental destruction are inevitably represented in the exhibits, but so are inspiration and optimism. That, says L. Worthy, is the power of art. It can deal with subjects we haven't quite got to yet, looking at them from a different perspective. It can tackle things which are uncomfortable. The statistics about soil make for uncomfortable reading. A combination of changing climate and land management has meant a third of the world's soils are now degraded, a process which is accelerating, eroding soil at a rate of 4 football fields a second. Leaving aside climate consequences for a global population that grows 95% of its food in soil, this is a problem. This is what motivates Courtauld and Elworthy to take the lessons they've learned beyond the garden. An exhibition tour and a Soil and the Land Gardeners, their nonprofit platform, where gardeners, growers, and farmers can share techniques, are brewing alongside the microbes. We're not saying we've got all the answers, says Courtauld, but we are saying, let's all share this collective knowledge so we can find some. Working together so closely, it may mean the two women have created their own ant and deck effect, but it has also made them a powerful force for communicating the message that an answer to today's polycrises might lie under our feet. And in a sidebar, soil improving tips from the Land Gardeners. Soil thrives if it is aerated, so if you have compacted soil, use a broad fork. It is covered by plants. Weeds are better than bare soil. You inoculate your seeds with compost or microbial inoculums. There is a diversity of plants. You use green manures such as buckwheat, phacelia, mustard, and crimson clover to cover, feed, and mulch the soil. You can plant them in between flowers and vegetables. You apply foliar feeds of compost extract, seaweed, or microbial inoculums during the growing season. You plant green manures with your flowers. For example, sow field beans over tulips. The tulips flower, then the beans come up. Cut the beans down, put in compost and plant cosmos seedlings into the stubble. More soil restoration tips can be found in the Land Gardener's book, Soil to Table, 45 pounds, published by Thames and Hudson, or Soil and the Land Gardeners on landgardeners.com. Soil, the world at our feet at Somerset House until April 13th. The website is one word, somersethouse.org.uk. We turn next to the wilds of South Africa's Northern Cape. In an article by Monica Mark, published on January 25th in the Financial Times of London, The Rise of Plant Poaching, How a Craze for Succulents is Driving a New Illegal Trade. The shopkeeper would like to begin by assuring you he never did touch one of those plants. He is not a thief, and he is not a liar. He is not sure, in fact, whether you are not some kind of double agent, sent by the Chinese, maybe, sent by him. But anyway, he never did take anything more than a man needs to get food in his belly, the way the ancestors used to do on these blessed hills. True, he happens to know a little about the trafficking of the items in question, but knowledge is not a crime. If you're not too vexed by the heat in his humble shop, he can share some truths about these mystery plants. It's a long story, but not too long. He can give you details he knows, which, like he says, isn't much. To begin with, he does not know why anyone would even want them. Because the truth is, these plants have turned life upside down for him and for many brothers here in Springbok, in the Northern Cape of South Africa. It is because of them that this sleepy stopover town of 13,000 people in the arid band of that unfurls along the country's western coastline is now at the center of a global poaching epidemic. Why is the conophytum so special? Love to know also, man, the shopkeeper says, flicking his copper-flecked dreadlocks. He looks out the doorway of his herbal medicine shop, past the main road with its boarded-up storefronts, toward the veldt beyond, as if an answer might be found in the wilderness out there, where the conos grow. From a biological perspective, the answer to that question is easy enough. Conophytum, or conos, are succulents that are some of the most unusual plants on the planet. Taking up to half a decade to reach maturity, most range from pinhead to coin-sized. Their tiny, water-swollen limbs take on hallucinogenic forms that would look at home in a Miyazaki film. To see a kono up close is to marvel at the intricacies of habitat adaptation. Conophytum burgeri is among those varieties known as living pebbles. After winter rainfalls, they shed a delicate, papery skin and become translucent and jelly-like. Others are known as dumplings, button plants, or water blisters. Conophytum maughanii sprouts a single, wild-looking flower between tiny, pouting lips. Conophytum concavum are prized because they look like miniature peaches. Or there's Conophytum minimum, Vita bergensa, which looks, as one Reddit user memorably described them, like a bouquet of eyeballs. In the wild, conos grow only on the plains of South Africa's Cape provinces and on the dunes of the Kalahari Desert in neighboring Namibia. That harsh environment has shaped them into marvels of adaptation. Many species are so endemic that they can only be on a single farm, hillside, or rock face. Ornamental succulents all over the world are under assault by traffickers, but a plant poaching industry estimated to have a black market value of 8.2 billion pounds has been particularly disastrous for conos. That many are rare and grow in incredibly remote places means they are highly coveted by collectors, hungry for exotic new plants. This, combined with the fact that they are mostly minuscule and therefore easily transportable, has made them some of the most trafficked species on the planet. The vast majority of trafficked conos end up in East Asian countries, where they have become status signifiers posted by their owners on social media. Demand for them has been likened to the craze for Pokemon or various cryptocurrency bubbles. In the 3 years to 2023, more than 1.5 million succulents were ripped from South African soil, which is home to one-third of all known species. 45% of them are now on the brink of extinction. So great is the concern about traffickers hunting down conos that scientists have stopped a centuries-old tradition of naming newly discovered species after their location. Because poachers also glean information from media coverage, this story purposefully omits details about locations and prices. The environmental destruction is not limited to the conos, said Ismail Ibrahim, a project manager overseeing endangered wildflowers at South Africa's National Biodiversity Institute. These are very dry, arid regions, and these systems are very complex and very fragile because of the interdependency between species. You don't know how much else you will lose because that one species is gone. The shopkeeper concurs, even as he has faced charges for poaching conos. His only quibble is who should be blamed for the unfolding ecological disaster. Top of his list are buyers, middlemen, and allegedly corrupt officials. They're stealing our magic, and now they want to lock us up for it. Over the few days we spent together last year, the shopkeeper told me a story that was, on the surface, a tale about a petty small-town feud. But in its own wild, deeply personal, and convoluted way, the tale aligned with what half a dozen experts later told me about kono poaching, a trade that is literally changing the face of the earth. It showed what happens when the quest to save a species comes up against the realities of life in a country where 1 in 3 people are unemployed. And it revealed an obscene truth about the triviality of our present moment, that a whole ecosystem can be under threat simply because of an internet craze for a trippy-looking plant. Everybody calls the shopkeeper Rastaman because no one remembers a time when he did not dress from head to toe in Hessian sacks stitched together. He threw out all his clothes decades ago when he joined the Sakmanis, Afrikaans for the sackcloth people. As a teenager, the Sakmanis are an offshoot of Rastafarianism blended with the traditions of South Africa's indigenous Khoikhoi and Sun and Sand people. Rastaman has piercing eyes set in a deeply tanned face. He goes about barefoot, smokes weed copiously, and tries his best to live off the land. On that late January morning when I met him in 2024, the day ahead promised to be long, sweltering, and uneventful. Same as always. So between serving customers, Rastaman was rolling spliffs on a sheet of cardboard balanced on his lap. He worked methodically, every so often lifting his eyes to the doorway. You had to be vigilant, he explained. If someone came in asking certain questions, I tell everyone like that. You! I know who sent you. And I throw them out. He blew a ring of smokes and watched it curl around the broken ceiling fan. The man who sent these spies, in Rastaman's telling, was a central figure involved in tackling Springbok's international poaching rings. He was also Rastaman's personal nemesis, apparently hell-bent on thwarting the shopkeeper's business ambitions. Somewhere around Rastaman's third spliff, one of his friends entered the shop and pulled up a chair. He nodded when the conversation turned to conos. Everyone wants to survive, a friend said. He pointed across the room at a young man lying on a tattered sofa asleep on a weekday morning. That guy had just done a stint in prison after being nabbed harvesting conos for foreigners who'd approached him on Facebook, he said. One day you get a message on your phone telling you you can make 8 to 10,000 rand, $535. A man approaches you and gives you a certain picture. You think, I'm not going to go to the desert for one picture. One picture? 10,000 rands. Who is to be blamed here? Poverty is a crime, Rastaman nodded. Somewhere in the middle of 2010, a few potted conos started to appear for sale on eBay. There was nothing remarkable about these postings. Conos have been legally cultivated for years, but partly because they have a long sleeping period, during which they can actually look dead, they have long been considered niche plants in the collecting community, appealing mainly to hobbyists or specialist collectors. Steve Hammer, after whom the tiny fingernail-sized Conophytum hammeri is named, is a top authority on South African succulents and runs the most famous legal succulent growing nursery based in California. In the early days, he said his customer base for Conos was, let's say, 30 customers who were willing to wait 3 or 5 years for plants to mature. In 2015, all of a sudden, he had thousands of orders from Chinese buyers, all wanting the same adult Conophytum, C. pagei, a plant which used to sell for $5, as a nice little nursery-grown seedling would go for $100 or $200, Hammer said. Around the same time, researchers were seeing a similar trend on other online stores. Suddenly, buyers were bidding astronomical figures, sometimes thousands of pounds for a single plant, said Andrew Young, professor emeritus of applied plant sciences at Liverpool John Moores University, who has helped discover and describe new species. These were insane prices for plants that are relatively straightforward to cultivate and have been grown for decades. On the ground in South Africa, others noticed what was happening. Harvesting Conos had been banned since the 1970s. In the past, collectors, usually from America or Eastern Europe, tended to keep a low profile by flying into the country and asking local tour guides to take them to the far-flung places where succulents grew. Occasionally, they would be caught trying to mail a box or two out from local courier shops. Their arrests were few and far between, said Dominique Prinsloo, a project manager at environmental conservation group Traffic. But then we started confiscating hundreds and thousands of plants. In 2015, a middle-aged Spanish couple posing as tourists were arrested with 14 cardboard boxes stuffed with endangered conos. In 2019, a Chinese buyer known as Dr. Flower was fined 150,000 rand, about $8,000, for illegally harvesting conos. The next year, two South Korean citizens were found with more than 60,000 conos. One of them was wanted in the U.S. for harvesting $500,000 worth of Dudleya farinosa, another kind of succulent, in California. Overstretched law enforcement scrambled to figure out what was behind the explosion in demand. At Kirstenbach National Botanical Gardens in Cape Town, a small team of botanists pivoted to overseeing cono cases in addition to their full-time jobs. Conservationists across the country were struggling to process and find homes for some 3,000 confiscated plants that needed to be repotted each week. Some conos are so hyper-endemic that a poacher could wipe out the entire population of one species in just a couple of visits. There were poachers literally going in with brooms and sweeping areas clean, said Abraham at the National Biodiversity Institute. The growing halls held another surprise. Poachers were finding populations we never knew existed, said Young, the professor at John Moores University. Part of the difficulty in protecting the plants is logistical. Much of the succulent Karoo, land of thirst, in Khoisan, is wild country encompassing private farms and rugged terrain. Roads were often washed away or impassable. And actually, finding conos is also sometimes really challenging because a lot of them are subterranean in nature. Sometimes you'll be searching for an hour, 2 hours for the tips of leaves, the size of a pin sticking out, said Ibrahim. The growing halls held another surprise. The pandemic turbocharged the trade. Millions of people all over the world stuck at home took up an interest in both online shopping and collecting houseplants, posting the most exotic ones on social media sites. Foreign collectors who could no longer travel found an easy, if exploitative, solution. They started recruiting locals to harvest the plants. For desperate people in South Africa, where the economy took a severe knock during COVID, this was a boon. By the end of 2021, conservationists had confiscated more than 300,000 succulents, but they estimated this was only 1/4 of the total harvested by traffickers. Some researchers believe the succulent trade today is bigger than that for rhino horns, controlled at the top by syndicate bosses whose reach extends as far as East Asia. In 2023, Prinz Lu, the project manager at Traffic, remembers being shocked at a bust of more than 40,000 individual Konos in a house in Cape Town. They had been labeled and sorted, ready for shipment abroad. It was a pivotal moment, the sheer number of these little bunches of plants, she said. It really hit home that what's going on is really, really shocking. Wreathed in smoke, one eye still on the door, Rasman began to tell me his story. Years ago, he said, there was a tall white man who knew the veldt almost as well as even Rastaman's own people. He knew all the plants and all the animals because he had learned about them in university. It was a different kind of schooling, but he was still very expert. This man used to take tourists into the wilderness to see the stunning flora there. But in Rastaman's telling, some of the tourists were actually plant collectors in search of Konos. Once in the veldt, they might quickly pluck one or two to take back home. They returned home and told others. The word spread. Then, about 5 years ago, interest broke beyond mere hobbyists. Big-time buyers, mostly from China and South Korea, wanted in on the ornamental succulents market. They reached out to the white man, who soon could no longer keep up with their demand for excursions. They were giving him too many locations to go and search for Konos, Rastaman said. These buyers started looking for local poachers to meet their growing appetites, approaching them directly on social media. This made the white man furious, Rastaman said. He should, according to the shopkeeper, have started asking locals for help. Instead, he started arresting them. The man was, after all, Springbok's celebrated flower detective, Captain Carol Dutoit, four times Northern Cape's Police Detective Employee of the Year. A barrel-chested man with a commanding presence, Dutoit was lauded among environmentalists for relentlessly chasing down poachers of every stripe as the commander of the stock theft unit. But now, if Rastaman was to be believed, Captain Dutoit was fixated on bringing down the shopkeeper himself. Cat and mouse game had begun, and Rastaman had become convinced that the cop was sending people posing as buyers to his shop in order to entrap him. Though, of course, Rastaman insisted he was no poacher. I had my doubts, but my main question was this. If Rastaman wasn't a poacher, why would a high-profile, presumably rather busy police captain be spending so much time trying to catch him? The long answer would unspool over days we spent together, but for now he had a simpler one. He wants to temptate me. And that's where we stop with this extra long article from the Financial Times about the evolution of the poaching business in South Africa. We'll continue next week. We close this week with a recent article by a new columnist for the Times of London, Anne Treneman. This article, What Kind of Gardener Are You?, was published on Saturday, February 1st in the Times of London. This week, I found myself up at 3 a.m., sitting in a bed, scribbling away at a list of my favorite plants. If January is all about grand plans and fever dreams, February is all about getting real. It suddenly seemed imperative to make the list that will begin to form a planting plan for my new garden. Most of you aren't starting from scratch, as I am in my new garden, but it is still an eye-opening exercise to make a list of your favorite plants, or perhaps what you'd like to see in your garden this year. The first plant? Much to my surprise, it was bronze fennel, which, light and airy, works in the front and back of a bed. Aromatic, good in salads and fish, excellent tea. I think the list is informative in that it nudges you back to which plants truly bring you fulfillment. It also reflects what kind of gardener you are. For some time, I have been working on creating a quiz that will point gardeners toward their tribes. My tribal categories are still a work in progress, and do feel free to send me more. Here's what I've got so far. Neat and tidy. You like a perfect lawn and enjoy experimenting with stripe patterns. Flowers are fine, but no floppy ones. you find the idea of embracing weeds revolting. Classic cottage used to just be called cottage gardening, now christened cottage core. Roses, arches, bulbs galore, lavender, curved beds includes a potager subcategory with a mix of flowers and veg. The specialist, you enjoy creating a collection and having a theme. Could be anything, including conifers, tropical, roses, alpines, white flowers, silver leaves, green foliage, and topiary. The perennialist, you're an avid fan of the new perennial movement dedicated to creating prairie bed of mid to tall flowers and grasses with all your successive flowering. Looks natural, quote unquote, but requires a huge amount of effort and planning. Trends are us. You love the latest thing. Early adapter of the bulb lasagna. Obsessive about dahlias. You've bought several display metal watering cans. Still trying to nail the Piet Udolf grass waving in the sunset look. Willing to spend a fortune on a mature olive tree. It's all about the party. For you, the perfect garden is paved with a few raised beds for cocktail glass flowers. Borage, anyone? You love the outdoor-indoor vibe, willing to spend on lighting, seating, and the holy grail, an outdoor kitchen. Birds and bees, the garden is full of wildlife furniture, i.e. bee boxes and a Manhattan-esque skyscraper of bird feeders. The summer lawn is a field, and you've had to put up a sign for passersby explaining that you aren't lazy, you're just doing your bit for nature. Save the world, type one. Big on fruit and veg, no-dig methods, natural pesticides, and fertilizers. Save the world type 2. Embracing drought-resistant plants in the face of climate change can be confusing, especially when it's been raining for weeks. It's all for show. As a garden influencer, you're devoted to creating luscious photos for others to drool over. Requires endless trips to garden centers, like Chelsea, but more cutthroat. Playtime. The garden is a toy graveyard. There's a discarded sandbox, an old Wendy house, a wrecked paddling pool. Every spring you buy bedding plants that then die. Pets are us. Your garden has gone to the dogs, or cats, or rabbits. The dogs are in charge, which explains the holes. Cats, never your own, are also bed wreckers. Shed life. For you, a shed or a greenhouse is a sanctuary and an essential part of life. This type may or may also value tools more than flowers. You can be several of these at once, and I always find it interesting to see what I am not. I'd love to be a perennialist, but may not have the patience. I do recognize myself in cottage core, potager subcategory, specialist, and in saving the world part one. I also love a greenhouse shed. My middle of the night must have list reflects this well with the Simon Garfunkel combo. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, wild roses, daisies, lavender, ferns, hostas, rhubarb, dark veg, nasturtiums, cornflowers, elderflower, spurges. I love my list. It makes me feel that spring is indeed on the way. That wraps up episode 280 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send us your comments at www.lars.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think of the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us even as we try to create order and structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty and of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardeners, other gardens, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky. Gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.